welcome to Religion in the News. I'm Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service, and today we'll be featuring articles from the Washington Post, from the New York Times, from Religion News Service, and more. Today's broadcast is generously supported by White Memorial Presbyterian Church. They can be reached at 919-834-3424, and we thank them for their contribution. The contents of this program are intended for people who are blind and print impaired. We begin this week's edition of Religion in the News with a relatively big story. In fact, this might be one of the stories of the year, even though we're not even halfway through January yet. This is from the edition of the Washington Post dated January 3rd, and the headline, United Methodist Church is expected to split over gay marriage, fracturing the nation's third largest denomination. The subheadline, church leaders said Friday they had agreed to spin off a traditionalist Methodist denomination while allowing the remaining portion of the United Methodist Church to permit same-sex marriage and LGBT clergy for the first time in its history. And this is by Julie Zosmer of The Washington Post. The United Methodist Church is expected to split into more than one denomination in an attempt to bring to a close a years-long and contentious fight over same-sex marriage. The historic schism would divide the third-largest religious denomination in the United States. Leaders of the church announced Friday they had agreed to spin off a traditionalist Methodist denomination, which would continue to oppose same-sex marriage and to refuse ordination to LGBT clergy, while allowing the remaining portion of the United Methodist Church to permit same-sex marriage and LGBT clergy for the first time in its history. The plan would need to be approved in May at the denomination's worldwide conference. The writers of the plan called the division the best means to resolve our differences, allowing each part of the church to remain true to its theological understanding while recognizing the dignity, equality, integrity, and respect of every person. The United Methodist Church is the United States' largest mainline Protestant denomination and among the only remaining such churches that still does not perform same-sex marriages. The church has fought bitterly about LGBT inclusion for years, and leaders often feared the fight would lead to a schism. Friday's announcement came as new sanctions were set to go into effect in the church, which would have made punishments for United Methodist Church pastors who perform same-sex weddings much more severe. 1 year's suspension without pay for the first wedding, and removal from the clergy for any wedding after that. Instead, leaders from both liberal and conservative wings of the church signed an agreement saying they will postpone those sanctions and instead vote to split at the Worldwide Church's May General Conference. They said the agreement was brokered by Kenneth Feinberg, the mediation expert who handled the compensation fund for September 11th terrorist attack victims, among other major negotiations. The agreement pledges $25 million to the new traditionalist denomination, which will break away from the United Methodist Church, a group that would likely include most of the church's congregations in Africa, as well as some in the United States. In exchange, Friday's announcement said, the new denomination would drop any claim to United Methodist assets, such as church buildings. Any local church that wants to join the new conservative denomination would have to conduct a vote within a specified time frame, the announcement said. A church would not need to vote to remain United Methodist. Churches that vote to leave could take certain assets with them. An additional $2 million would go to any other new denomination that wishes to split from the church. The plan also calls for $39 million to ensure there is no disruption in supporting ministries for communities historically marginalized by racism. After the separation, the agreement said, the remaining United Methodist Church would hold another conference with the purpose of removing the church's bans on same-sex marriage and LGBT clergy. The 16 members of the negotiating team that reached the plan included bishops from New York, Florida, Louisiana, Ohio, the Philippines, and Sierra Leone. The team also included leaders from the most pro-LGBT Methodist factions, including Reconciling Ministries Network, and the most conservative, including the Wesleyan Covenant Association and Good News. American Protestants are generally divided into three theological and cultural camps: evangelical churches, which almost unanimously oppose same-sex marriage and view gay conduct as sinful based on their reading of the Bible, historically African-American denominations, which are more divided on the issue, and mainline Protestant churches, which tend to be both theologically and politically more liberal. Though mainline churches have a deep history in America, most of the founding fathers and most presidents since have been mainline Protestants, Pew Research Center's 2014 count found that just under 15% of Americans now identify with mainline churches, while 25% are evangelical and 20% are Catholic. Many mainline denominations, including the Episcopal Church, Presbyterian Church USA, Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, United Church of Christ, and others, already perform same-sex marriages and appoint gay clergy. But the United Methodist Church, the nation's largest mainline denomination and the third largest denomination of any faith in America, has fought bitterly over the issue, to the point that leaders have feared a schism over the topic for years. In part, that reflects political division in the United States. American Methodists are more conservative than other mainline Protestants. Pew Research Center found in 2014 that 54% lean Republican and 35% lean Democrat, a significantly more Republican tilt than other mainline denominations. 15% of Methodists describe themselves as liberal, compared with 22% of mainline Presbyterians, 24% of mainline Lutherans, and 29% of Episcopalians. But the larger divide is between American Methodists and foreign members of the United Methodist Church, especially churches in Africa. In a church that conducts all of its major decisions in church-wide votes, the much more conservative-leaning voters from Africa competed with American delegates who often fervently pushed for a change on same-sex marriage. At a conference last year, where church leaders had declared they would solve this issue, many American delegates favored a plan that would have allowed local churches to make their own decisions on whether to perform same-sex marriages and ordain gay clergy. Some supported a plan to simply allow same-sex marriages worldwide. They were stunned when a third option passed instead, one dubbed the traditional plan, which ushered in not only a continued ban on LGBT weddings and clergy, but harsher penalties for those who disobey church doctrine. Resistance to the vote began almost immediately. Groups of clergy met in several cities over the past months to formulate alternative options. We'll continue on religion in the news this week with a short article from the December 31st edition of the News and Observer. This is by Martha Quillen of the NNO, and the headline, "With Elections and Gay Rights Debate, Faith and Politics Are Likely to Collide in 2020. The coming year is likely to generate plenty of fresh material for the writers of sermons and social policy platforms, with the confluence of the election cycle, some major U.S. Supreme Court decisions, and at least one possible denominational schism. Religious faith seems destined to become more of an issue in state and national elections, as some Republican candidates, such as U.S. Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina, suggest that Democrats are bent on quashing religious freedom in America. Democratic candidates are increasingly being pushed to proclaim their faith as a supporting pillar of the policies they put forth. The 2020 campaign may turn out to be, in part, a contest between Tillis and his Democratic opponents' interpretation of the tenets of the Christian faith. The U.S. Supreme Court is expected to issue rulings in 2020 on three cases that, while they don't deal directly with religion, could have an effect on religious institutions. The cases, Bostock v. Clayton County, Zarda v. Altitude Express, and EEOC v. Harris Funeral Homes, center on the rights of gay and transgender employees and whether federal employment law prohibiting sex discrimination protects LGBTQ people against workplace discrimination. If the justices say yes, it could mean, for instance, that an institution such as the Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary in Wake Forest would have to reconsider its rules allowing disciplinary action against any faculty or staff who engage in sexual activity with another person outside of a monogamous heterosexual marriage between one biological male and one biological female. Another religious institution, the United Methodist Church, will inch closer in 2020 to a resolution of its rift over the ordination of gay clergy and the marriage of gay and lesbian couples. The UMC's governing body voted in 2019 to strengthen language in its Book of Discipline banning gay clergy and gay marriage, but there was no mass exodus by church members in the U.S. who disagreed with the decision. In May, delegates to the denomination's general conference will meet in Minneapolis and discuss whether there is any way for the church to remain whole, and if not, what an amicable dissolution would entail. At least two municipalities in North Carolina will be checking their lists twice next year to make sure no naughty groups try to make trouble during their annual Christmas parades. Just before their planned holiday parades of 2019, the towns of Garner and Wake Forest both canceled their events after hearing that pro- and anti-Confederate flag protesters were planning confrontations because members of local Sons of Confederate Veterans chapters would be participating in the parades. In towns where private entities, rather than the municipal government, organized the Christmas parade, SCV chapters might be barred from participating because of the potential for controversy. Wake Forest officials said they plan to explore the option of turning the parade over to a local group to run in 2020. Our next article this week comes from the January 1st edition of the New York Times, and the headline, 90,000 Jews Gather to Pray and Defy a Wave of Hate. The subheadline, A Celebration to Mark the End of a Cycle of Talmudic Study, carried extra meaning in the wake of deadly anti-Semitic attacks. This is by Joseph Berger of the New York Times, Dateline, East Rutherford, New Jersey. For the past century, thousands of Jews have participated in a shared and daunting religious feat, reading the same page of the Talmud every day until they finish all 38 volumes of that central text of Jewish religious law and rabbinical debates. The task takes almost 7.5 years to complete and ends in a colossal party. On Wednesday, Jews thronged MetLife Stadium to mark the occasion, but this time a recent nationwide wave of anti-Semitic attacks freighted the communal celebration with extra meaning. On a windy and biting cold day, the gathering offered a chance to affirm their faith in the face of those terrible acts. Some believed the event contained echoes of Jews who were held in ghettos or concentration camps during the Holocaust and resisted their persecutors by saying clandestine prayers, teaching their children the Torah, or furtively blowing a ram's horn on Rosh Hashanah. You can't compare it completely, but we're showing that we're not going to allow these attacks to change our course, change our language, change our clothing, change our God, said Daniel Retter, an immigration lawyer whose parents escaped Austria under the Nazis and who participated in the Talmudic study with a dozen other members of his synagogue in the Bronx. An estimated 350,000 Jews all over the world take part in the movement known as Daf Yomi, which means page a day in Hebrew. In synagogue study halls, Wall Street boardrooms, and even on the 7:51 a.m. Long Island Railroad train from Far Rockaway to Penn Station, they study the same two-sided page each day until all 2,711 are completed. Many, like Mr. Retter, choose to start the cycle all over again, anticipating new shards of insight or wisdom. Mr. Retter had completed his sixth Daf Yomi cycle. The movement has become so popular that the New York area ceremony on New Year's Day not only drew 90,000 participants, filling the home of the football Giants and Jets in the New Jersey Meadowlands, but also attracted 20,000 to the Barclays Center in Brooklyn. There were smaller celebrations in 80 cities in 15 countries, according to organizers. The celebration, known as a Siyum Hashas, or completion of the Talmud, was organized by Agudath Israel of America, the ultra-Orthodox umbrella group that initiated the program in 1923 as a way of unifying Jews and their practice in a growing diaspora. Another organization, Dirshu, also sponsors Daf Yomi study and will hold celebrations at the Prudential Center and two other spaces in New Jersey on February 9th. The vast majority of those in MetLife Stadium were Orthodox men, many from Hasidic and other ultra-Orthodox sects, and their dark suits and hats gave the stadium a charcoal cast. There was a special women's section so wives and daughters could cheer their men on. Although an increasing number of modern Orthodox women engage in Talmud study, more traditional adherents sharply differentiate gender roles. We have our role, and the men have their role, said Avigail Gleiberman, a 29-year-old bookkeeper who came to the stadium with her husband and extended family. Although we take Torah classes, the bulk of my day is consumed with work, taking care of my children and supporting my husband. For some, this year's celebration did not have quite the exuberance of those in years past. It was shadowed by an unnerving awareness that Jews in the United States have become the targets in the past 14 months of sometimes deadly anti-Semitic violence in Pittsburgh, the San Diego area, Jersey City, New Jersey, and Brooklyn. On Saturday, a gathering of Orthodox Jews lighting candles for the seventh night of Hanukkah at a rabbi's home in the New York suburb of Muncie was invaded by a man wielding a machete. He stabbed five of the guests, leaving one rabbi, Joseph Newman, with a skull fracture. In a statement, Rabbi Newman's family said he may not regain consciousness. Prosecutors have charged Grafton E. Thomas, who they said had been doing internet searches for "Why did Hitler hate the Jews?" His family and lawyer have said he has a history of mental illness and no anti-Semitism in his past. After that attack, the Daf Yomi celebration was seen as not just an act of faith, but one of defiance as well. The Talmud has gone through the Crusades, the pogroms, the Holocaust, and too many atrocities to name, but the Talmud and the Jewish people have persevered and maintained our roots and will continue to grow, said Yossi Gleiberman, a watch importer, father of five, and Mrs. Gleiberman's father-in-law. The Talmud, assembled between the years 200 and 540, is the central source of Jewish religious law and consists of debates among hundreds of rabbis about the fine legal points gleaned from more generalized teaching in the Torah, the first five books of the Bible. The discussions take in ethics, philosophy, folklore, and rituals and cover almost every aspect of an observant Jew's life. The stadium program featured a host of speeches and singing and dancing by men, but its highlight was a reading of the last paragraphs of the final volume of Talmud, the tractate Nida, concerned with menstruation and other aspects of feminine physiology, followed by a reading of the first sentences of the first volume of the Talmud, Berakot, or Ritual Blessings, that many will start next week. A special Kaddish, a prayer usually recited at a graveside, was chanted at the conclusion of the last page of Nida. Like Mr. Redder, many of those at MetLife Stadium were children or grandchildren of Holocaust survivors and had grown up hearing stories of random attacks against Jews. But there is an essential difference between those attacks and more recent ones, Mr. Redder said. Now, thank God, we live in a nation of grace and favor. The people who enforce the law want to protect us, Mr. Redder said. Another member of Mr. Redder's Daf Yomi group, John Mann, a professor of psychiatry at Columbia University, whose parents escaped the Warsaw Ghetto and were liberated at the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp, said the celebration highlighted community and survival itself. Persisting in that study, he said, tells the world we're not going away. We're here to stay. Our final article this week on Religion News Service comes from Religion News Service, and it was published on January 2nd. It's a rather lengthy article. We may have to edit it a bit for time, but I'll get to as much of it as I can. The headline of this article is, "Where Will the Next Decade Take Religion? Experts Predict the Future of Faith." And this article is written by Aisha Khan, who conducted the interviews of the people that you'll hear in the story. The past 10 years have witnessed monumental demographic shifts in the U.S., catastrophic natural disasters, and new urgency on climate change. A reckoning on sex abuse among religious groups from the Catholic Church to the Shambhala Buddhist community. This decade has seen the re-election of the country's first black president and the election of the first president to call for an outright ban on Muslims entering the country. It has been marked by world-shaking movements such as the Arab Spring, Occupy Wall Street, Black Lives Matter, and Me Too. Migrant crises at the United States southern border as well as in Africa and Asia, the rise of bots and social media disinformation campaigns, the legalization of same-sex marriage matched by a revolution in the way Americans think about gender and sexuality, the death of Osama bin Laden and the rise and fall of the Islamic State group, terrorist attacks, school shootings, and violent attacks upon houses of worship, movement on the legalization of marijuana, the beginning of the Syrian civil war, violent extremists, the controversial hearings on American Muslim radicalization and the launch of federal countering violent extremism programs, and new attention to mental health, among countless other trends, movements, and headlines. What will the next decade hold? We asked scholars, faith leaders, activists, and other experts to reflect on some of the biggest shifts in religious landscapes they have seen over the last 10 years, as well as the biggest themes in the world of religion that they expect to emerge in the 2020s. The views expressed in these submissions, which have been edited lightly for length and clarity, do not necessarily reflect those of Religion News Service. From Kiati Joshi, A Reckoning for Religious Minorities in the U.S. and India. The past decade has seen America's immigrant religious minority communities emerge with effective and forceful self-advocacy. Hindu temples, mosques, and other houses of worship are suing for the right to build, rather than avoiding conflict and settling for inferior locations as many previously did. Sikh Americans have fought for the opportunity to serve in the military, police, and Secret Service while observing their faith's tenets. These groups are staking their claim to physical and rhetorical space in the public square. Simultaneously, segments of white Christian America fear that the nation is losing its identity. This fear has resulted in vocal and violent religious discrimination, the Muslim ban, state-mandated teaching of the Bible in public schools, and laws barring teachers from penalizing students who give faith-based answers in science class. I'm keeping an eye on these growing bonds of nationalism and religion in America, as well as in India. In both large, officially secular democracies, a rising tide of thought and official action links national identity with the majority religion. Notions of real Americanness weave together whiteness and Christianity, while Indian national identity and policy grow increasingly Hindu. India has seen Hindu communities policing minorities' diets. The Supreme Court resolution in favor of Hindus in the Ayodhya territorial dispute between a mosque and a Hindu temple, and the Citizenship Amendment Act, which singles out Muslims for less favorable treatment as immigrants and refugees. Both nations approach a crisis point. In India, rising protests and the government's violent response will spark a reckoning about how the nation treats its minorities. And next year, Americans will either re-elect a president who plays to the shrinking white Christian majority's basest xenophobic instincts, or a diverse coalition will elect a candidate whose vision of a more perfect union embraces religious difference. And for note, Joshi is a professor at Fairleigh Dickinson University and author of New Roots in America's Sacred Ground, Religion, Race, and Ethnicity in Indian America. The next bit comes from Luke Goodrich, who is an attorney at the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty. It's titled, SCOTUS Will Rule During an Era of Unprecedented Religious Freedom Conflicts. One major shift in the past decade is that traditional Christian beliefs about abortion and marriage are increasingly viewed by some parts of society as a threat to modern culture. The result has been significant, unprecedented religious freedom conflicts involving traditional Christian views. Examples include the over 100 federal lawsuits filed over the contraception mandate, culminating in the Hobby Lobby and Little Sisters of the Poor decisions by the Supreme Court, and the increasingly common litigation over conscientious objectors to same-sex marriage by religious wedding vendors, schools, counselors, and adoption agencies. In the next decade, expect the Supreme Court to issue multiple significant decisions on religious freedom. In the context of abortion, expect the court to affirm the long-settled principle that no person can be forced to participate in an abortion in violation of his or her religious beliefs. And in the context of same-sex marriages, expect the court to make good on its promise in Obergefell, its landmark decision affirming same-sex marriage, that religions and those who adhere to religious doctrines may continue to advocate with utmost sincere conviction that by divine precepts, same-sex marriage should not be condoned. In other words, the court will recognize that our country is deeply divided on matters of religion and sexuality, and it will hold that the government doesn't get to pick one side of that debate and punish everyone who disagrees, but must instead protect the equality and dignity of both sides of the debate. From Wardak Khalid, who is the founding president of the Polygon Education Fund and a congressional fellow with the Asian Pacific American Institute for Congressional Studies, Muslim political engagement will reach new heights. 10 years ago, I started a blog called Young American Muslim in response to the Islamophobia I witnessed around President Barack Obama's election and began speaking about the dangerous consequences of the Islamophobia network. At the time, Muslims were constantly being put on the defensive. As Americans asked, where are the moderate Muslims? Why don't Muslims condemn terror? Many of us felt education could help solve the problem. Today, as hate crimes against the community have reached their highest levels since 9/11, exacerbated by bigoted rhetoric in the media and the nation's highest political offices, Muslims have moved beyond that. They are now joining the media and policymaking process themselves to define their own narrative. America's estimated 3.8 million to 8 million Muslims will continue to build political power, motivated by Islamic values such as peace and justice. We will see voter registration and engagement with elected officials rise alongside more Muslims running for office. working on Capitol Hill and organizing at the grassroots level around domestic and international issues. At the national level, we'll see deliverables such as presidential policy platforms, in parentheses for the first time, and improved coordination between Muslim civic engagement organizations. And while I'm afraid Islamophobia during the 2020 presidential election will still emerge, I'm hopeful that it will be met by swift condemnation and successful calls for accountability by our interfaith allies, politicians, and the media. From Ryan Burge, who is an assistant professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University, where he researches the intersection between religiosity and political behavior in the U.S. Interested in the rise of the nuns? Keep an eye on the year 2029. I wanted to predict what American religion would look like in 2030 by extending the current trend lines of the seven major religious traditions in the United States. More specifically, I was interested in how long it would take for the religiously unaffiliated, who have seen major gains over the past decade, to be clearly the largest group in the United States. The answer that was derived from my projection model is 2029. That is the point at when the model says that if the so-called nuns grow at the slowest rate, they will still be any larger than any other group, regardless of the margin for error. At the same time, the two other large religious groups in the United States, in parentheses, evangelicals and Catholics, will each make up about 22% of the U.S. population. The only religious tradition that will sustain serious losses is mainline Protestants. These are the moderate forms of American Protestantism typified by United Methodists and Episcopalians. Today they make up about 10% of Americans, but in 2030 that will be cut to just under 5%. That result is stunning considering that this group made up 30% of the population in 1976. At the same time, it's noteworthy that for Black Protestants, Jews, and those of other faith traditions, in parentheses, Mormons, Buddhists, Muslims, Hindus, the next decade will likely be one of stability and consistency. Obviously, projecting religious demography into the future is a difficult proposition, and a number of factors could make these predictions look very silly, including national tragedies or spiritual revival. However, it's undeniable that American culture and politics will slowly begin to change as the nuns continue to rise. Read more about the assumptions built into this projection and some of its results in a blog post I wrote for Religion in Public. There are still quite a few more of those predictions for 2020 in the next 10 years. From Religion News Service, and we'll feature some of those in next week's edition. But we've run out of time for this week, and we thank you very much for listening. I'm Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service, and don't forget that you can take podcasts of Religion in the News with you no matter where you go. Just visit our website at ncreadingservice.org and click on the Listen tab, and then find Religion in the News, and you can take it as a podcast wherever you go. Today's broadcast was generously supported by the White Memorial Presbyterian Church. They can be reached at 919-834-3424. We thank them for their contribution. And we thank you for listening to this edition of Religion in the News. If you see a story you'd like to have featured on a future edition, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. We'll talk to you next time on Religion in the News.